want to open the House Committee on Human Services. On Valentine's Day, February 14th, welcome everyone. It's not going to get any more romantic than this, so we're all glad that you're here. This morning, we're going to have a little change in the agenda to accommodate our colleague, Representative Lindsay. So I'm about to open a public hearing on 2878. We'll take Representative Lindsay's testimony, then close that. We'll go back to the order that you see if you have an agenda. So I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2878 and welcome Representative Lindsay and others.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and colleagues. For the record, I'm Sean Lindsay, represented from House District 30, also known as the district where the President of the United States will be visiting this Friday.
Oh.
Very excited about that. I'd like to first start off by saying thank you to the Department of Human Services. I'm joined by Kathy Prouty of DHS Adoption Services. I'd like to thank them for all the hard work and good work they do in this world of tons of litigation and dirty politics here and there, except in this Capitol. It's great to see families that are being created. And when our families are strong, our society is strong. I was recently informed of a couple of couples back in 2007, 2008 who had applied to DHS for adoption, to do a home study. And for one reason or another, based primarily on rule, they were denied an application to do a home study because they had, in addition to the DHS application, they had also applied to an independent agency. And based on whatever rule or maybe even a misreading of that rule, they were denied an application. DHS corrected that rule by changing the rule. And it's, just for the record, it is OAR 413-120-0220. They changed it, but unfortunately the rule was reverted to the bad rule and then fixed again. And we visited with DHS and agreed that when I submitted my House Bill 2878 to present an amendment codifying the rule as it is today, which is correct. And so we're here today, which I think is just a cleanup bill, which is a -1 amendment to codify the rule as it stands today, which is correct. And with that, I'd be happy to answer your questions, and if Ms. Prouty wants to say anything, that's fine as well.
Okay. No. Any questions for the representative? Seeing none.
One. Can't let him just...
Representative Harker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was right with you until you mentioned a -1 amendment. Do we have a -1? Okay, I'm not looking at it. I'll find it.
Great.
And I will have caught it.
I didn't see it either. Hold on.
Thank you.
Just if you would repeat for the slow learners, certainly not me. Again, the -1 is
so currently as the OAR is written, it is correct and perfect, but it is not in the statute. It is not in House Bill 2878. So what we did was amend House Bill 2878 to bring in the OAR, just codifying that rule into statute. And the -1, you should have electronically as well as a testimony by one of the families that was affected, Todd Harrison.
Okay. There's no other questions. We thank you for coming. And I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2878. And we're going to return to the regular agenda, and I'd like to open an informational meeting that we carried over from last week on seniors and people with disabilities. And if Director Taves will come back up, we'll resume. Good morning.
Good morning.
co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam and members of the committee. James Tays from the Department of Human Services, seniors and people with disability programs. I believe that we were going to resume on slide number 13. We concluded the developmental disabilities part of the senior and disability program. We're going to move on to the aging and physical disability program. And just parenthetically, the aging and disability program operates off of a completely separate Medicaid waiver from the developmental disabilities program, and have a whole set of different federal requirements, and that's why we kind of present them as separate programs. Starting with slide number 13, for seniors and people with physical disabilities, the senior disability program, our state offices, and in many cases area agencies on aging do all the eligibility. The legislature many, many years ago created sort of a one-stop shop for seniors and people with disabilities. So we do eligibility for Medicaid. We do eligibility for food stamps, for the Oregon Health Plan, for Older American Act programs, for Medicare savings programs where we pay co-pays and premiums for Medicare for poor seniors. All of that's done in the same place. Seniors don't have to jump from office to office to have that eligibility work done. Out of those offices, we do all the case management. We do Older American Act services, which is a separate act, separate from Medicaid, that's not restricted to income. So we can do broad outreach to seniors, meal sites, senior centers in many of your districts, some legal services. Caregiver support is all done under the Older American Act programs that, again, is contracted through area agencies on aging. We have a big in-home program. All of our nursing homes, foster care, assisted living are all part of the senior and disability program. On slide number 14, describes the number of people that we serve currently in this program. The total is almost 28,000 individuals, seniors and people with physical disabilities, are receiving long-term care services. Almost 19,000 are over age 65. The balance are people with disabilities. And then you can see about 114,000 seniors and people with disabilities getting Oregon Health Plan coverage or food stamps or Medicare savings programs. If you go to slide number 15, this just breaks down, and APD means aging and physical disabilities. APD caseload by county. In each county, it describes service eligibility and financial eligibility, and that's an important distinction. Service eligibility means people that are Medicaid eligible plus get actual services, long-term care services, be it in-home or foster care or assisted living or nursing home services. Financial eligibility simply means they're Medicaid eligible for the Oregon Health Plan or food stamps or part of the Medicare programs or combinations thereof. The next page, slide number 16, is Older American Act and Oregon Project Independence. And the reason we depicted these two slides separately is, again, Older American Act programs and Oregon Project Independence are not income-based or not means-tested the way the entire Medicaid program is. Although for Oregon Project Independence, we do indeed do a fee schedule for people that are able to pay. But nonetheless, it's not restricted to people that are Medicaid eligible. And here's the breakdown by county of Older American Act services and Oregon Project Independence. Again, all contracted under federal law through area agencies on aging. Slide number 17 is really the trends going back to 2001 of the caseload for the senior and disability program. And it's this and the next couple slides are quite remarkable in that they are so different from the trends in most parts of the country. There are only, I think, five or six states that actually spend most of their long-term care dollars on the community side as opposed to the institutional side. A vast number of states still spend 70, 80, 90% of their entire budgets on nursing homes. Oregon, beginning in 1981, The legislature passed a pretty dramatic legislation that recast the Oregon system, and over that entire period since 1981, a whole network of community-based facilities has developed in Oregon. So these trends really show that. The biggest program, of course, being the in-home, where home care workers under the constitutionally established Home Care Commission actually go into people's homes and provide direct care in people's homes. And then you can see the other types of facilities. The nursing facility line has come down, not so dramatically since 2001, but still continually has declined slightly. If you look at the home care population, you'll see the top orange line. It took a big dip in 2003. That was when we did some significant budget reductions in the senior and disability program during that recession, and we cut service eligibility for people.
Excuse me just a second. Ours aren't color, so just to clarify.
I thought they were colored. I really apologize.
That's all right. That's all right. So the line you're talking, the orange
line. The top line. The top line.
Yeah.
Co-chair again.
And while I've got you stopped for just a second, when we say in-home on this slide, is that part of OPI, or is this different?
Co-Chair Gilliam, if you go to the next slide, number 18, you'll see exactly the breakdown of Oregon Project Independence. But and I do want to talk about that for just a second. So back to slide number 17.
Yep.
The top line is the in-home program, excluding OPI, and I'll get to that next slide. And again, there was a dip in 2003 when we did budget reductions and cut off the lowest impairment levels at that time. So obviously people with less impairments typically were served in their own homes. And I think about 5,000 individuals actually lost services during that particular period. But again, most of our care is provided in community settings. If you look at slide number 18, and this is a real important one. Again, this stands in pretty stark contrast to most parts of the country. Again, about evenly split between in-home and community-based care facilities, and those include foster care, assisted living. Assisted living began in Oregon. It was pioneered in the early 80s in Oregon and has obviously caught on across the rest of the country. We have residential care facilities, a lot of them serving people with severe dementia that are in that community-based care facility part of the pie chart. Nursing facilities, you can see the figure there. Oregon Project Independence, and it's important to put it here, but it serves a much smaller number, but again, it's not income tested, and it involves individuals that need a little bit of help, be it chore services or some respite care or a home care worker actually going in for a few hours a day to assist the person with activities of daily living, anything it takes to sort of keep the person or that family intact. We have ironically looked at various times at the people who get Oregon Project Independence, and some of them, a significant number, are actually Medicaid eligible but choose not to avail themselves of Medicaid services, and one of the drivers that we've always heard from individuals saying why is they don't want to sign up for the whole estate recovery. You go in, and if you sign up for Medicaid services, you have to sign that line saying your estate eventually after your death will be liable to pay the cost of your care, and many seniors are just resistant to that, understandably so. So they'll actually stay on Oregon Project Independence, which actually is a good deal for the state, because Medicaid is a complete wraparound. It's an entitlement program. You get the full Oregon health plan. So if families can stay intact with a little bit of help, that's good for them, and it's good for all of us. OPI, and I call it OPI. I shouldn't use initials, although everybody knows it as OPI, is often described in the statute. It was created in 1975, so it even preceded Oregon's entrance into the Medicaid program. And in the statute, it says OPI is intended to keep people out of nursing homes. Really, that role has shifted. When you look at this pie chart again, it's in-home care and community-based care facilities for Medicaid individuals that really keep people out of nursing homes. OPI contributes, but it's not sort of the sole program as it was in the mid-70s.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Greenwood.
Can I follow up just on that statement
75 was before Oregon got into the Medicaid program?
Co-chairs and Representative Greenlee, yes, Oregon entered the Medicaid program for home-based care,
okay.
I should say.
That was in
1981. In 1981, we filed the first home and community-based waiver plan with the federal government, and OPI was started in 1975.
We were in it. We were in Medicaid before.
We were in Medicaid, but on the nursing facility side.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So the program you were talking about that avoids Medicaid is the in-home, not the OPI. You can opt out, so to speak.
Co-Chair Gilliam, everything here is Medicaid with the exception of Oregon Project Independence. That's a general fund only program. All the rest are Medicaid funded, typically a 60% federal match, 40% state. And what I was trying to say is what keeps people out of nursing homes is your vast array of community-based services for people who are already receiving Medicaid. And again, OPI preceding the Medicaid program was the only thing that people had to resort to. Now, as they spend down their income or their assets and become Medicaid eligible, they have lots of choices in community facilities. Moving on to slide number 19, obviously the demand for long-term care services is going to grow very rapidly, even explode. Currently, about 13% of Oregon's population is over age 65. That'll be 20% or higher by the year 2030. The fastest growing sub-cohort of that are people over age 85. Typically, when you look at the demand for long-term care services, it's about 1 in 4 or 5 for someone between 65 and 75, about 1 out of 2 or 3 for 75 to 85. 85 plus, it's 1 in 2, so it just really escalates. And so when you look at the 85-plus group, that's the group that will enter long-term care. So the overall numbers of people over age 65 will double, but again, the 85-plus will grow even faster, and that's going to create a tremendous demand for long-term care services. It's interesting to note that long-term care, based on all national studies, about 25% of over age 65, I thought that was number high, but it's actually been validated by different studies, about 25% of people over age 65 have some need for activities of daily living. It may be quite minor, but nonetheless have some minimal need for activities of daily living. The sub-percentage of that, about 20% of the 25%, or you'd say 5% of those over age 65, have needs for assistance in three or more activities of daily living. So by then, it's a fairly significant amount. Oregon currently serves about 4% of the plus 65 age in our long-term care system in the Medicaid program of people who have spent down. And the point is the vast majority of care is still provided by families and family members. And that's important to focus on as we look at how we design our system for the future. Moving to slide number 20, these are the challenges that are facing the aging and physical disability system. Obviously, the changing demographics. A couple years ago, we had a significant decline in the number of programs across the state willing to serve Medicaid-eligible individuals, and many facilities were switching almost exclusively to private pay. Oregon's long-term care system in many ways has focused on a good balance between Medicaid and private pay, and that's very, very important because you want people that are purchasing long-term care services with their own income and assets to have good choices, to have less expensive choices, so they don't quickly spend down and become Medicaid eligible. If you look at other states that have only nursing homes, people go in, they spend down very quickly and become Medicaid eligible. So it's always been important for us to have a balance between private pay and Medicaid. We were losing that balance some years ago, and then the February 2008 special session actually did a rate increase for foster care, assisted living, and community-based facilities that really began to stabilize that. But that will always be a challenge for us as this population expands significantly. we're serving more and more people with very complex challenges in community settings. I think there's the risk of not providing adequate care as we continue to increase the level of acuity or the complexity of need. And we've tried to keep our community services to be non-medical kind of services and not emphasizing nursing and other kinds of medical supports. But obviously, if you have people with really complex needs in community settings, they're going to need more of those wraparound services. And then the bigger issue really is the workforce issue as we look 15, 20, 30 years down. I think everyone is very concerned about the entry-level workforce that provides so much of the direct care and where that workforce is going to come from. Even if we have the dollars to pay for it, will we be able to hire enough workers to provide care for this rapidly growing population? On page 21, again, similar to the developmental disability side, we do licensing and quality of care for thousands of different facilities that are both publicly financed and also purchased with private pay, but with individuals using their own income and assets. We do all the quality of care and licensing for both. Page 22, in the next couple slides, emphasize what we've attempted to do in the last couple of years, which we call CQI, or continuous quality improvement. We have, in the senior and disability program, frozen our staffing almost for 2+ years now, and we allow a few positions to get through through exceptions, but we are, depending on the program, anywhere from 10 to 15 to 20% down in our staffing ratios, which has meant that we simply have to figure out ways to improve and streamline our work because we have less and less bodies to do that. We have a four-person team that does nothing but go from program to program, do what's called rapid process improvement, which is a skill set that is quite remarkable in being able to break down tasks, reorder them, figure out how to create easier steps, figure out the challenges on the information technology side, and really, again, try to reconstruct programs to be much, much more rapid and thus needing less staff. Pages 23 and 24, as part of the department's transformation effort, wherever we've been able to, we've calculated a dollar amount that we think has been saved, or in some cases it's number of days for eligibility. If you look at in the middle of slide 23, we do presumptive medical eligibility for anyone who presents themselves as disabled requesting Medicaid. We do a presumptive eligibility. It used to take us almost 85 days. We cut that down to 38 days, and that's just an example of trying to go program by program and really minimize the staffing impact as our staffing shortages certainly will continue into the next couple of years. Let me skip to page 25 and 26. As part of our continuous quality improvement efforts, we also, both on the developmental disability side and on the senior and disability side, have sat down with all of our field partners, our county partners, the AAAs. We've tried to go through all of the layers of paperwork and bureaucracy that is in the long-term care system. We did a whole series of focus groups in the last 6 months, had a couple of efficiency summits, and again have developed a very long task list of those activities where we think over time we can again shorten the timelines, shorten the paperwork, and try to be a much leaner organization. Let me just skip the next couple of slides and go to slide number 28. These are the major caseloads and budget drivers that will face the long-term care system in the next couple of years. An obvious one is the economy. We've been studying, and we'll study more, all the latest entries into long-term care, and really try to determine, as I mentioned earlier, the biggest majority of long-term care is still done by families. And we've tried to really ascertain how much the economy contributes to families no longer being able to provide that care. And really haven't come up with a discrete caseload percentage of that, but we are very much aware as new people become eligible and spend down, that families themselves are really struggling, and that's having an impact on our growing caseloads. federal policy has thrown a lot of curves our way. We're having to implement in the next year what's called the automatic verification system, where we have to go out through a major contract and look at a person's assets 5 years back and look at all the banks in surrounding states where the person might have lived. It's a huge cost that's being imposed on the states. We don't think will likely produce very many outcomes, but that's a major curve that's been thrown our way.
Could you talk, Mr. Chair?
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Could you talk some about why that's being required?
Co-Chair Tomei, it was, and I don't know if it was part of the Deficit Recovery Act or when it was exactly passed, but it was one of those things in Congress where they thought there were a lot of people that were cheating or skimming on Medicaid, and therefore we needed to do much more thorough checks to see if people had any assets or bank accounts that were somehow hidden and didn't get picked up in Medicaid eligibility. We really doubt it will produce very much of an outcome, and I think most of the states agree with this. And as the federal government started imposing this requirement on the states, actually most governors wrote back to the president, to Congress, saying this is very expensive. The costs will way outweigh the actual results. But I think that was the theory, is to try to crack down wherever possible on people that might have been hiding assets.
Follow up.
So the idea is that people have to spend down in order to be eligible for Medicaid, is that correct? And so concern was the feds felt like people were hiding assets somewhere and they really didn't spend down and they shouldn't have been eligible for Medicaid.
Co-Chair Tomei, again, to be Medicaid eligible in this state, well, in fact, in most states, you have to have an income of about, it's a little over $2,000 a month or less, and have less than $2,000 in assets, excluding some things you can keep, like your own house and a few things like that that are excluded. So it's really on the asset side for people that might have been hiding assets that would have put them over the $2,000 limit that this particular requirement was focused on.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Moving to slide number 29, and Erin, when she was reporting on CAF, did a similar thing. Several years ago, the legislature passed a bill requiring us to come back on a regular basis and benchmark where we are on our caseloads and our workloads. We've had several different independent studies trying to look at workload and what appropriate ratios are to be. And this is kind of how it's been benchmarked at this time. If you look at the bottom columns, which is both the state offices with state employees and then much of our field, which is contracted through area agencies on aging, you can see for 2011 in the current biennium that the current position authority is about 1,430 positions compared to what's earned, and a difference, so we're at about 84% of our staffing ratios, but in reality it's actually much lower than that, because both we and our partners have in many cases frozen positions as the budget situation has become more dire. So it again shows us falling short of what is an appropriate workload standard, but again mitigated wherever possible with process improvement and ways that we can streamline our work. Slide 30 is just a graphic representation of that same issue. Slide 31.
Hold on just a second. Representative Harker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back on slide 29, if you would, sir. Looking at that same bottom line in the 11-13 forecast, there's an asterisk by the word forecast, which I don't see defined anywhere, but if we have 1,430 positions now. I understand it's not enough to deal with the caseload. What encourages us to believe that we will have 1,700? Or am I misinterpreting? I've certainly done it before.
Co-chairs and Representative Harker, these aren't the positions funded in the proposed governor's budget. This is simply what would be earned in a workload forecast, and I can actually get the number of positions that are actually proposed in the governor's budget. But that's the positions that otherwise would have been earned based on the caseload projections. We obviously won't fill that number of positions, and it probably will be much less than the 1,430 that are just to the left of that.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative.
I'm sorry, just for my own clarification, because I've not seen a budget before that, can you just tell me, when it says positions earned, what's the earned part of that in terms of caseload or management, or what's the formula that goes into that? Because that's not language I've ever seen in a budget I've seen before. So,
co-chairs and Representative Parrish, positions earned are based, everyone, if you look through these positions, case managers, and there's some letters here that should be spelled out. APS means Adult Protective Services. PASS is screening for people that are potentially nursing home eligible or that we're trying to divert. Eligibility workers, paraprofessionals. Each of these has a discrete caseload standard. For example, for in-home programs, I believe someone will probably shake their head in disagreement and back, but I think the caseload for in-home programs is like 1 to 67. So every one of these has a discrete caseload that's based on independent studies that have done time studies to see how many staff it actually takes to do that body of work. And then we do our caseload forecast of people that will end up in each of those different program times, and it simply computes to a proposed staffing standard.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that clarification. I appreciate it.
Co-chairs, going to the last slide, page 31, slide 31. These are the really big challenges that we face in the next couple of years as we work through the budget process. The caseloads, as I mentioned, will continue to grow. They're not expected to grow hugely in the next biennium, but in 4 to 6 years, they will really begin to take off with the aging demographic. Nonetheless, they will grow in the next couple of years. Federal health reform has locked down Medicaid eligibility, meaning that no state can actually change eligibility for Medicaid services until, I think, 2014. Why that's important to us is in looking at budget scenarios and budget reductions, we still have to serve everybody coming through the door, even if those numbers are increasing, and obviously we'll have much less resources to do that. There's basically three places where our budget goes in long-term care. One is the number of people we serve, number two is the rates we pay to providers, and number three is the staffing in the central office in the field. So one of those factors is off-limits in terms of eligibility. It's very interesting. Margaret Carter and I spent some time on the Hill last fall trying to educate some of the members of the Senate Finance Committee that were still working on health reform on some of the implications here. And really the focus was on Medicaid eligibility for medical services, and long-term care was kind of an afterthought. But nonetheless, our eligibility is completely tied up, and the federal government has made it very clear that unlike what we did in 2003 and actually changing eligibility to accommodate our budget shortfall then, we can't do that. We have to serve everybody coming through the door. So that means all the budget reductions have to come out of the other two places, be it central office in the field, which I think will pare down by anywhere from 10 to 20%, and provider rates, which currently in the governor's budget, provider rate reductions are anywhere between 15% and 20%. The other issue that then faces us in potential rate reductions, be it rate reductions to nursing homes or assisted living or reduced benefits for home care workers, wherever those budget scenarios have to be negotiated, since it's part of the Medicaid program, we also have to get approval from the federal government even to make those rate changes. And in states already, particularly in California, where some of those rate reductions have been proposed, the Centers on Medicaid and Medicare, and backed up by the federal courts, have said you can't make across-the-board percentage reductions. You have to benchmark it against a market basket study of rates, and you have to absolutely assure health, safety, and access. So if providers, as a result of rate changes, no longer can stay in business, you have to absolutely guarantee there are other providers right there to pick that up, or you cannot compromise health and safety. So in looking at all of our potential budget changes, we'll have a long series of negotiations with the federal government as well. We actually started that when the governor did the two separate allotment reductions this past year in the Medicaid changes, some of which were then restored by the emergency board. We had to file amendments to our Medicaid plan and begin lengthy negotiations with the regional office and their headquarters in Baltimore. So that's going to be a lengthy process that we and all the other states will have to engage with the federal government. And finally, again, as we look at our Medicaid rate structure, since it's pretty carefully balanced with our private pay, we again have to really pay attention to the payer mix, because if our Medicaid rates change so dramatically and providers can't keep up that part of the work and suddenly it jeopardizes the rest of the people that they serve on private pay, obviously we have a major impact on seniors and people with disabilities that goes just beyond those people that are funded by the state. So those are the significant challenges we face in the next couple of years that we'll be working through in the budget process. With that, Chair, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Greenlee.
Can you talk about how the nursing home tax plays into this whole question of financing and reduction?
Co-chairs and Representative Greenlee, the nursing home tax has been a huge benefit for us. When we started in 2001 or 3, I'm blanking on the years, actually Oregon had some of the lowest nursing home reimbursement rates in the entire country. And as part of the nursing home tax, we've actually caught up and in some cases exceeded other states. The nursing home tax, nursing homes give us detailed cost reports. We take those cost reports and we then rank all nursing homes from top to bottom in terms of their allowable costs, and then we pick what's called the 65th percentile. So you go to the 65th percentile and everybody gets at least that rate. I'm trying to think of the per day rate that we're at right now that escapes me. And they send that tax to us. We're able then to match it with additional federal dollars, which is how it's helped fuel that increase. If we...
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, follow up.
I don't even understand what you just said, and I think I knew it before you said it.
Co-chairs and Representative Greenlee, the tax, and it's a broad-based tax. It's not just on Medicaid, but it's on all of their bed days. It's a broad-based tax. We tax them a dollar amount per day, which they send to us. We then can match that with additional federal dollars. So, in effect, your Medicaid program is a combination of federal and state dollars. You're taxing all of that. You're taking it back, and you're matching it sort of again with federal dollars, which is why the federal government had some real concerns about the nursing home tax, but has allowed it, and Congress kind of stabilized it a couple years ago. If we drop nursing home reimbursement rates, we collect less tax, so that's a problem because it's sort of a double whammy. We also have in Oregon an exemption for high Medicaid, low Medicaid users, and it's a very complicated formula, and I could get you lots of details about that. But it will have effect if we cut nursing home reimbursement rates. It also means we collect less tax and in turn then can match less federal dollars.
If I may follow up, where I was going is could you increase the tax? Nursing homes give us a tax. We match it with federal dollars. We give them back their tax in terms of increased rates at least a one-to-one. If we're going to cut nursing home rates, would they be willing to increase their tax as a way of get more federal match that would give them back some or all of the rate reduction that we're planning on getting? That's where I was going with this question.
Co-chairs, Representative Greenlee, the answer is not really, and the reason I say that is there is what's called in the provider tax world a safe harbor over which you really shouldn't go without jeopardizing your Medicaid portfolio. It used to be 6%. Congress set it back to 5.5%. I think that that prohibition in Congress expires, so I think we're probably going back to 6%, so we can probably do a slight increase sometime in the middle of the biennium, but in terms of being able to do a giant hike that would generate enough revenue to offset losses, the answer is probably not.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ed. Speaking of the federal government, now, just generally speaking, what are your indications that these matches are going to remain at these levels? Do you get communication from them, or do you just have to get bad news when it comes?
Co-Chair Gilliam, the federal match rate is based on law, and it's really calibrated against the state's sort of economic situation. Typically, Oregon has been 60-40, 60 federal, 40% state. As part of the Federal Stimulus Act, that was hiked to about 71% federal and 30% state, and that's obviously how we were able to backfill a lot of the general fund losses for the current biennial budget. That, of course, goes away since it was part of the federal stimulus, and will revert back, we think, to about 60 or 61% back to the standard rate, and again, benchmarked against the state's economic situation, its unemployment, things of that sort. We don't really expect in bad times before stimulus sort of became a dirty word, often during a recessionary period, the match rate would be increased. It was increased significantly in 2003. That helped us through that recessionary period. But now that it's become part of the overall stimulus issue, it's in all likelihood it will not be increased this time again. So we will go back to the standard rate.
Any other questions? I wanted to go back to at least the positive side of what otherwise is, as usual, a daunting report. And that's the savings that we have as a state. I have a high-placed volunteer source that has asked me to ask you a question. And it's not really a trick question, but it just sort of spotlights. Do you have an idea if, in fact, our Oregon model of long-term care is enviable and sort of pioneering? Do you have any idea since 1981 how our approach in long-term care has saved costs on a cumulative basis?
Co-Chair Gilliam, I was actually doing some research on that, and I can get you some estimates. The only caution I throw at that is often people in a place like Oregon say that if we didn't have our long-term care system, the total number of people we serve would have ended up in nursing homes. So you could basically say our budget would have to be 2 to 3 times what it is now, because nursing home rates typically are 2 to 3 times what it costs on the community side, and OPI is even a much, much smaller amount than that. And other states that have only nursing home services often have a much narrower window on eligibility. I would say, though, for OPI, and again, it would be a very big estimate at very best, but for someone on OPI who otherwise might be Medicaid eligible, if they come into our system, it's about $2,000 a month into a nursing home, about $6,300 a month. OPI is usually only a couple hundred dollars a month. If you look at someone in a community facility, again, somewhere home care program, about $1,000 a month, assisted living residential care, $2,000 or more, a nursing home, $6,300. So at each of those levels, if you didn't have that level and the person had to go to the next level of care, it would be 2 to 3 times the cost. So we can do a rough estimate, and also what I was trying to find were the spending trends by state, and I think we can provide that with you that will give you a better estimate of what a state that doesn't have Oregon's long-term care system is actually spending on long-term care, and I think that'll be a better analysis.
And I would, this person, who shall remain nameless for the moment, is an extremely dedicated and watchful person. He's been very involved in seniors' issues. And I guess the reason I'm highlighting it is because this person and others in my district and elsewhere have been so glowing and so adamant about the importance of OPI, which I know you understand, but I just think it's important to put it on record. I think there's a lot of issues that you've raised in the whole overview of your department, but I don't want us to be, what's the cliche, cut off your nose to spite your face. I don't want us to forget, as small as that piece of the pie OPI might be, how much it saves. The number he gave me, which I cannot document here today, but is that his estimate is that we've saved $675 million since OPI started. How you project that, to your point, is difficult. But the main point is this, that our model, particularly OPI, of keeping people in their homes as long as possible, and I know I'm sort of preaching to the choir here, but I think it's worth saying, and many of us have faced this in our own families. I know I have. It isn't just the money. It's obviously the quality of life and so forth, keeping people, seniors who get to a point where with just a little bit of assistance, they can stay in their own home and hopefully save a lot of money. And so the quality of life and also the cost. So I just want to be sure I go on record as saying, as difficult as this budget is, I hope we take a very close look at that program and making sure folks can stay in their home. It just is good policy, in my opinion. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Chair Gilliam. I'm going to echo your comments. It takes very little time to go into one of the many senior centers that are in my district. And before someone begins to talk about OPI, everyone knows about it. Everyone lauds it. They consider it a primary part of the success that we've had in Oregon, and success for themselves, for personally. So, I will echo your points there. Thank you.
Can I voice a slightly contrary opinion?
All right.
No, you can't. That's it. Yes, Representative.
Warning. I think OPI has been a political football from the very beginning, and every year the governor, whoever the governor is, or somebody puts up OPI on the cut list because of the sure answer is that it'll be taken back off the cut list when it's done because it has a lot of political juice. But the fact is, we're going to be talking about cutting some huge amounts out of our budget, and if we can keep somebody in OPI for $200 a month, and basically I think that's what I heard James say, for many families that's not an insurmountable money to pay themselves. I mean, is it nice? Yeah, and if someone is eligible for Medicaid, then you're saving money in OPI in a sense. But I ran a program for 25 years where we were able to sell essentially OPI coverage as a part of the social HMO at Kaiser as a part of health insurance, and most of the people who are on OPI are not the most needy families financially. Some are, but not all. And the fact that OPI is not means tested when we're its alternative to take away general funds from other parts of the budget from people who are much less able to take care of themselves is a problem. And I think we need to be thinking about how we can link OPI, that OPI population, with case management services in the community so that for families that can afford $200 a month, we find a way. They get an OPI, and the reason they need to be there is because it's very hard for them to figure out how to do the services that OPI provides. I think there are alternatives to OPI that will get these people these families services that are desperately needed. There's no question. Do we need to keep them out of nursing homes? Absolutely. But is OPI the only way to do it? Well, it's the most popular way to do it. But general fund-only projects are going to be really scrutinized in this budget. I mean, when we're cutting billions, perhaps, out of the human services budget, OPI is not going to be protected in the same way it has been in the past, I predict. Do I love home and community-based long-term services? I spent the last 25 years working in that area. I do love it. And it really makes a huge difference keeping people in their home. But I think we need to test the assumption about OPI very carefully, particularly the fact that it's not means-tested at all.
Thank you, Representative. And where we may or may not disagree, I think we're on the same page of prevention and keeping folks in their homes, how we fund it. You make some points. But I just want to underline the idea of our philosophy, if you will, of long-term care in the state as it relates to keeping folks in their home as long as possible, funding of which is going to come under close scrutiny.
Absolutely.
I think we agree.
Absolutely. Thank you for letting me go off on a little sermon.
I've asked you not to test me in public like that.
You say but 68 million?
You just won't listen. Thank you for your comment.
Co-Chair Gilliam, yes. If I can make a comment. One of the potential bright lights in something like OPI, because we've struggled for years whether we could figure out some way to get federal match as well, because, again, it sits there as a pure general fund program, which also always makes it vulnerable in a cut list. As part of federal health reform, there was a little tiny piece of long-term care reform that was tucked in, which I don't think will be funded, but I think people have finally recognized that most caregiving is done by families. And if there's anything we can do to help support families before they spin down and get on Medicaid, and basically Congress said we ought to do two or three things. We ought to do intensive options counseling. So when mom or grandma breaks her hip, is in the hospital, the family is completely at a loss of what to do. Our system isn't very good for that. I mean, we are if you're poor and you come into the Medicaid. But we ought to have very intense options counseling right there to help that family make a good choice. We ought to provide a little bit of in-home support as a transition, something like OPI. We ought to do some of the chronic disease management and some of the other things that will keep people healthy and safe. And the intent was actually to make that part of the Older American Act program and expand it, which is an 80-20 match. So there may be some hope down the road. But I think people are beginning to recognize it's the whole non-Medicaid population as this demographic explodes that we really have to pay attention to. We can't simply sit in the weeds and wait for people to spin down and come our way because they'll come so fast and we won't be able to afford it. So all of these approaches for the non-Medicaid population really have to be pursued, I think, in the coming years.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions from the committee?
Well, we thank you.
Thank you.
For coming in two parts. We appreciate it very much. I'm going to close the informational hearing on seniors and people with disabilities. And I'm going to ask the committee to stand at ease just for a moment.
I shouldn't say session, into open committee.
Yeah.
And what I'd like to do now is skip to the end of the agenda for just a moment. And you'll see under possible work sessions, we're going to work 2460, and right now we're going to, I'll open it in a second, we're going to work 2051. Those in the middle, 2057 and 2058, will be held over since we do not have a fiscal statement. So now I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2051. And the chair is open for motions.
Mr. Chair, since we got,
Madam Chair,
we got the fiscal impact and it's a minimal expenditure impact, I move that we move House Bill 2051 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Chair Tomei has moved House Bill 2051 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, I'll ask the clerk to call the roll.
Representative,
I'm sorry, just a moment. Representative Greenland.
I sense we want to, is it after we pass it, request the Ways and Means be taken off?
It has a fiscal
representative. It's minimal, but it's minimal, but it has one. So I guess we could not ask.
So that. We can't ask it not go to Ways and Means.
I don't think if it has any fiscal, we can stand there and ask. I think if there's any fiscal, we have.
This
to
is something to clarify because I'm not sure either.
Then
the committee will stand at ease for just a second.
Okay. Then I didn't realize that.
We were.
Mr. Chair, I rescind my motion to send House Bill 2051 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Can you make up your mind?
Hey, it's Valentine's Day. Give me a break.
Okay. Because of my affection for Chair Tomei, we're going to rescind her motion at this time, and I'm going to close the work session on 2051, and we'll discuss it further at another time. So, we don't. So we're not. Okay. Further update for all of you following along. I have a question. First of all, we heard part of 2878, and I want to see if we have another potential testifier in the room. Is Todd Harrison here? Okay, good. That's helpful. We're not going to go back to that. And I had already said that we would work 2460, and as it turns out, there's no fiscal report yet on that, so we will not be hearing any more of the bills under possible work session. However, I would like to continue now and open a public hearing on House Bill 2038. And I would like... I'd like to ask my vice chair, our vice chair, Representative Thompson, if he would read what the measure does for us.
I want to thank you for this opportunity.
You're welcome.
Future, could you mention that to me like the day before?
No.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
And now that he's learning how to do it, you can carry it on the floor as well.
Yeah, measure 2038. What the measure does... aligns Oregon and federal law as related to the expression of milk in the workplace. I assume that's from people.
Yes.
Okay.
Stick to the script.
It does not say that here. Eliminates the exemption from providing rest periods for expression of milk for employers of 50 or more employees if granting the rest period creates an undue hardship on the operation of the business. Declares emergency effective on passage.
Thank you, Representative.
You're welcome.
There are several people that wish to testify, and I would like to go first to our colleague who used to hang out with us, but now she went to the other side. And
to the dark side.
I didn't say that, Senator. So we're glad to have you, and if you'd identify and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Gilliam. And I have a couple of friends with me. If they could come up,
absolutely,
too, that would be great. So good morning, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, and members of the esteemed committee. I am State Senator Diane Rosenbaum, appearing today in support of House Bill 2038. And also I'm appearing in my capacity, along with the good co-chair from Milwaukee, as chairs of the Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Alliance. So we are very, very excited to introduce this hearing on House Bill 2038. Those of you who were here in 2007, which looks like not all of you by any means, will remember that one of the landmark achievements in 2007 is that Oregon passed a breastfeeding in the workplace bill, which was due to the hard work and advocacy of the Nursing Mothers Council, of the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, and many other advocates. And so the bill before you today makes us even more excited that we were able to pass that bill at that time, because what ended up happening after 2007 is that last year Oregon's bill became the model for now a national law, which went into effect in 2010, and this bill simply sheds more light on the fact that we know that making it easier for nursing mothers to come back to work, to be able to express milk, have a quiet, clean place to do that, enables them to continue breastfeeding their infants in those crucial first few months of life, which is absolutely, as you, I'm sure, will hear shortly, really essential to dealing with obesity, to dealing with all sorts of childhood diseases, to having healthier kids, and ultimately healthier Oregonians. So having a law like this in place is good for everybody, and it's also a good thing for employers to have uniform standards that they can apply and understand how to make it work. I think that you will hear shortly from the Bureau of Labor and Industries about the technical aspects of this bill, so I won't go into those. Obviously, there were some differences when the federal law passed between the applicability standards and some other features of what was already in state law, and we're trying to make those conform, and we have to do that, in fact. But just to highlight again that this is really something for Oregon to be proud of. We do have a high rate of moms continuing to breastfeed and being able to go back to work and do that, but we could always do more in that respect. But clearly the law that we passed in 2007 went a long way to helping in that respect, and we think that this bill before you today will do even more of the same. And Oregon can be justifiably proud, once again, as in so many other respects, for leading the nation and becoming a model. So thank you very much for hearing the bill today, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and I hope it will have a speedy route on the way out of here and to the floor so that we can take it up in the Senate, too. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for Senator Rosenbaum? Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Gilliam, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall. I'm the Legislative Director at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We appreciate the opportunity to be here before you today testifying in support of House Bill 2038 to align our Oregon state law with the new federal expression of breast milk in the workplace law, and to create a clear and consistent standard for employers and employees alike. As you just heard, the Oregon legislature passed House Bill 2372 in 2007, which required employers of 25 or more employees to provide unpaid rest periods of up to 30 minutes to their employees to express breast milk in the workplace. The Bureau was charged with the enforcement of this new law, which took effect January 1st, 2008. Since passage, we believe that this law has worked well for both employers and employees alike, as evidenced by the relatively few number of complaints that we've had. Coming out of those complaints, no enforcement action has been taken to date. They've all been resolved. In 2010, as you just heard, federal legislation was passed that extended this protection to women nationwide. As a result of this new federal legislation, there's now a couple inconsistencies between our Oregon workplace protections and the federal protections. House Bill 2038 addresses three main inconsistencies between state and federal law. The first has to do with subject employers, the second has to do with the frequency and timing of breaks, and the third has to do with an undue hardship exemption. So first I'll talk about subject employers. Our state law applies to employers of 25 or more employees, whereas federal law applies to all employers subject to the Fair Labor Standards Act. So by deleting, House Bill 2038 deletes this provision and applies our state law to all employers. Next, the frequency and timing of breaks. Our Oregon law provides for a 30-minute unpaid rest period to express milk in the workplace. Federal law, on the other hand, is a more need and frequency-based timing and allows for a reasonable time each time an employee has a need to express milk, which could exceed the 30 minutes provided in state law. House Bill 2038 replicates this language and the federal need and frequency-based timing. Currently, our state law provides for an undue hardship exemption for employers of any size. Under federal law, this exemption is limited to only employers of less than 50 employees. House Bill 2038 amends this exemption to mirror our federal law and allow for an undue hardship exemption only for employers of less than 50 employees. With that, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 2038, and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Representative Parrish.
For the record, how does one, as a small company that you know would have a hardship, how do they seek that?
There are, Chair Gilliam, Representative Parrish, there is, in current state law, we have an expression of breast milk in the Workplace Advisory Committee, and there are provisions that if an employer thought that they had a situation that might be an undue hardship, they could bring it to the advisory committee for the advisory committee to review and make recommendations on either rules or actions that the agency might take. And to date, we actually haven't had any employers requesting that the advisory committee take up any particular situation. And I believe Amelia will speak a little bit more to some of the good work that she's done with employers to help, you know, one-on-one through a particular situation, try and figure out some creative ways to do it, and I think has been tremendously successful in her efforts.
Thank you.
I'm going to hold my questions. I have several about this bill, particularly for you, but I'd like to invite you to go ahead if you'd like with your testimony. I'm not sure. Are you with the department as well? No.
No.
I'm sorry. Go right ahead.
Good morning. Chair Gilliam and distinguished members of the committee and co-chair Tomei. For the record, my name is Amelia Pismyth and I'm the director of the Breastfeeding Coalition of Oregon, and I'm very pleased to be before this committee again, this time to support the proposed changes to this law. It will make it easier to understand and to communicate and to implement. Under Chair Tomei's leadership in 2007, this committee set a precedent with a very thorough airing of the issues and then a unanimous due pass out of a bipartisan committee. And indeed, when Senator Merkley took this forward to the national stage, as he promised that he would do, it passed out of committee also, a bipartisan committee, and also unanimously. There is tremendous support in our country for breastfeeding, and there's tremendous understanding that the majority of women return to work and that without accommodations of a supportive workplace, they're not able to continue breastfeeding the way that they need to. Expression of milk in the workplace helps with that. Because of several years now of experience in implementing our law, I've worked extensively with the U.S. Department of Labor since March when this federal law went live, helping them think through how to develop their guidance and implementation. And I also want to commend the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industry for availing themselves to the U.S. Department of Labor. They provided expertise and documentation, a lot of which has been listed directly into the interim guidance that the DOL has just published. I also want to speak to the ways that we've been able to work with employers and with employees. I think that the fact that there have been so few complaints and no requests for exemption has a lot to do with the work that the advocates who lobbied for this law have taken. It's been an extremely active role to help find positive, creative ways to implement this in a variety of work settings. And our main takeaway at this point is that where there is a will, there is a way. And so we've been able to be successful, by and large, with implementing this in environments that we thought would be very difficult, including military personnel, public safety workers, mobile and construction workers, assembly plants, restaurants, coffee shops, and retail outlets. We're finding that even medical school residents and parking garage attendants have been able to find ways to make this work. And sometimes that process is really simple, that it's just maybe the employee needs a lock on a room, that she's experiencing intrusion, and then other times it's a much more detailed and lengthy conversation where I need to go way down the rabbit hole learning all about the specific job duties that she has to find the component that can be shifted to make the space or the part of the physical work environment that could be adapted in order to make breastfeeding accommodation or milk expression accommodation in the workplace possible. But so far, we found people to be very positive once they understand the documented health benefits for moms and babies and also the documented economic benefits for employers. And finally, I just wanted to highlight that our Surgeon General just 2 weeks ago has launched a new Surgeon General's Call to Action to Support Breastfeeding. There are 20 different recommendations about specific ways that we can be supporting breastfeeding mothers, and four of them are specific to the workplace. So I'm very pleased with what this committee's done. I'm very pleased with what Oregon has done. And when looking at this particular issue today, you have the opportunity to, again, set a precedent. You are now the only state that is looking at reconciling your state workplace accommodation law with the federal law. And many eyes are upon you. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Is there any questions? Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. It really isn't a question. It's just information for the committee and maybe some people in the audience. Mr. Chair, I think that you were the person who carried this bill on the floor of the House, and I think you did an admirable job, and I think we had almost a unanimous vote on that, or very close.
Yes.
Yes.
And we had them all until I actually spoke on the bill.
Well, thank you for the work you did.
And I appreciate you saying that, and it was an honor to carry it and to be on your committee at that time. She, as you all know, Representative Tomei was the chair in 07, and it was my first experience in the legislature, and we had four women and three men, and we found a way to understand this and to work together. Now, there's good and bad news in that for me. I mean, I'm going to be honest about my opinion on this bill. I'm very proud of what we did. And I think there was, quote, compromise in the bill in the respect to this. I was very concerned about small businesses, mm-hmm. and now I'm concerned about them again. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to be cooperative with our federal brethren, and we have to be mindful of matching statutes. I don't enjoy, it's one of my least favorite phrases in this building is, oh, this is just to comply with the federal government. And so I'm going to reserve that legal jargon to others that have legal training. But I don't want to match up to the federal standard if we weaken the bill. And in my opinion, we could. I've got some questions to ask. If we weaken the bill that we passed, I'm not very excited about the federal government coming in over top. I think there are things in the state law, in our original bill, that are stronger than the federal. And I think there are things that weaken it, again, from my opinion, that weaken our bill in this bill. So I'm looking forward to some discussion. We may have to have ongoing questions with you if you'll stick with us today or if we have additional hearings. I'm looking forward to the small business community. That's the group that I'm worried about. You have no argument here. I want to make sure people understand before we go further. You have no argument here with the importance from a nutritional standpoint, from the care of a mother and child. You've got no argument here on that. That's well documented, and I accept that. I embrace that. But a law that says same for all businesses,
can put a real hardship on small businesses. You know, it's one thing for the Bank of America to comply, and it's another for a small mom-and-pop organization in Silverton to comply. These are very different situations. So I want to be sure we talk about that and address that. I was very eager to hear this, and I agreed with Chair Tomei that we should, but I told her at the beginning I have reservations about the bill that I think ought to be aired and discussed in this committee. So just to be really clear about that. I would entertain questions. Representative.
I just hope you don't entertain it too frequently, but I have concerns with this as well, even the first time when we'd done it on the House floor. And I worry sometimes when we start putting mandates on, if you hire a woman, you have to do this and this and this, to where when you get two equal candidates who come up in front of an employer and he sees, oh man, she's a woman and I have a guy as well, that he's going to err on taking the side of the guy because he has to do all these extra hoops to accommodate the woman because she might get pregnant, she might have this, I might have to, and I just worry about hurting women in the workforce, in the workplace. And when we start doing a lot of this stuff, this is the kind of thing that could happen. So when I look at this, I want to make sure, this is Representative Gilliam, or Chair Gilliam, so I forget to elevate him at times, but Chair Gilliam was referring, what are we doing to small businesses, and what are we doing to women in general when we start moving legislation like this? So those are kind of the concerns that I have, and I don't want to see them discriminated against, and I can see this creating an environment where that possibly could happen when you're looking at two equal employees. So that can filter into employers when they're doing their hiring process.
Are you inviting a response from our witnesses?
If they would like to respond to it, I would like to hear their thoughts and the thought process of how they've taken this into consideration as well.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and I am going to have to leave for another meeting, but I would like to say to the co-chairs and to the good representative that, of course, it's illegal to discriminate in hiring based on somebody's gender, but I think the bigger point about this bill, you know, the same thing was really said about having family leave laws originally, that it would make it harder for people with families to get jobs, and I think it's been quite the opposite. I think, you know, the point about having a law in the books, which Oregon does, and now a federal law, which we will have to comply with, is that this is really good for everybody. It's not a bill for women. It just so happens that women are the ones that breastfeed babies. Breastfeeding is well established to be of benefit in terms of saving money long term and future health costs and obesity and all of these things. And the reality is that women who are moms need to work just like everybody else does. And so when we passed this law back in 2007, overwhelmingly, I think we were saying we are just acknowledging the reality of having working parents and that this is a bill that that makes that statement. The other thing I did want to say, and this is to the good co-chair, I think that if you look at this bill and hopefully as you discuss it further, you will find that it really is consistent with the bill that we originally passed. Clearly, one of the things that we hear from employers all the time is what a hassle it is for them to have more than one standard that they have to comply with. You hear that a lot about the family leave laws at a federal level and a state level, and I think it is really important that what the bill does is just says that this federal law will now be the law of the land in Oregon. When you think about the small business situation, this bill now actually expands the hardship exception that
is in Oregon law and says that if you're an employer with 50 or fewer employees, you will still be allowed to make a case that it's difficult and it's a hardship to be able to accommodate the other provisions. So I think that that, together with the fact that the federal law does apply to every employer and we don't have a choice about doing that, we will ultimately have to do that, means that it'll enable us to have a streamlined set of standards that allows for the unique interests of small business and still keeps the intent of our original law in place. So,
thank you, Senator.
And I'm sure others will make more eloquent responses because I do have to go. Thank you very much.
I appreciate that encouragement. I just want to be sure. But thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
Maybe you could invite Bowley to respond to your concerns and Representative Wagner's.
You're welcome to do so.
Thank you, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. As the agency that's also responsible for enforcement of our civil rights law, sex discrimination is something that we take very seriously. And that would be, you know, if a woman were to find herself being discriminated against in that aspect, I think it would be an issue that definitely would be against the law, and one that our civil rights division would take very seriously. But that being said, I think the experience that we have had under state law really demonstrates how well this law has been working for employers, and that it has been something that has not been difficult for them to comply with and to provide the rest periods for women. In fact, it's something that I think has not been difficult, and that's very much evidenced by the few complaints that we've had. In regard to Representative Gilliam's concerns about wanting to maintain a strong Oregon law, our intent in drafting this legislation was absolutely to be maintaining the stronger of the two standards, but again, to make it consistent and clear between state and federal law. So there are some places that state law is, in fact, a little bit stronger. Like it provides for the rest periods up to the child, up to 18 months of age for the child, whereas federal law is only 12 months. We did not make any change to that because we feel like it's important to maintain those breaks for the full 18 months. So, thank you.
We have a question.
Absolutely.
Thank you. So, could you please respond to Oregon law said 25, if there, this applies to employers of 25 or more employees, that Oregon law, and federal law said the exemption is available for employers of less than 50 employees. So I'm seeing a nod and then a shake. So which law would be applicable in Oregon?
Chair Gilliam, Chair Tomei, members of the committee, both would be. So with House Bill 2038 and federal law, there would the expression of breast milk in the workplace breaks would be provided, would be required of all employers subject to the Fair Labor Standards Act, subject to all employers. The undue hardship exemption, on the other side, would only be available to smaller employers of 50 employees or less. All employers would have to provide the breaks. Only employers of 50 or fewer employees would be able to claim the undue hardship exemption.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. Would you talk a little bit about the undue hardship exemption? How do I do it if I'm a small business person? How do I ask for the undue hardship exemption?
Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, there's two ways I think that an employer could do this. The first is, as I mentioned earlier, coming to our expression of breast milk in the workplace advisory committee and presenting a situation that made compliance for that particular business difficult to comply with. I think the advisory committee, although I can't say because we've never had a request come before it, would contemplate that situation, would learn more about the particular industry, would discuss with employees, with the employer, what types of accommodations had been attempted, what had been possible. And then at the end of that process, the advisory committee would make a recommendation to the Bureau, either about rules or enforcement in that particular instance. The second way is there is an employer could claim an undue hardship defense when if they were faced with any sort of enforcement action of not providing the rest periods. And we have it is spelled out both in statute and more detailed in our rules what sort of factors we would look at in evaluating an undue hardship exemption. And it is some they are factors such as the nature and cost of complying with the providing the breaks, the overall financial resources of the covered employer's facility, the type of operations conducted by the covered employer, et cetera.
How many businesses have qualified since 07 for a hardship? Do you happen to know that figure?
We have, sorry, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, we have not had any employers come to our expression of breast milk in the workplace advisory committee, and we have not. We have currently one case under investigation where the employer is claiming an undue hardship exemption, but it has not. It's a relatively new case, and it's still under investigation.
One.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And no, I think you testified, no enforcement has taken place. You know, this is one of the beauties of this. Again, I express my irritation at this. It's a good bill, and no enforcement's taken place. You have one person asking for an exemption, and here we are discussing the federal, trying to match up to the federal. So, you've already brought this up, but I would like to talk about it a little bit further. If we're truly conforming, then why don't we address the length of the term? That is, we're opening this up, so why don't we go with the federal 12-month versus 18-month?
Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, we believe at the Bureau of Labor and Industries that the original law passed by the 2007 legislature was well-reasoned, it was well thought out, it had been something that the legislature had considered with both business and employee groups, and we feel strongly, and I'm sure that Amelia can speak more eloquently than I can to the health needs and benefits of nursing to the full 18 months. So we felt like it was an important standard to maintain in our state law. We also felt like this was an issue that the Oregon legislature had contemplated and come to 18 months being the right provision to provide.
You're welcome to respond as well.
Yeah, as a follow-up, Chair Gilliam and members of the committee, I can also let you know that on the federal level, advocates have very strong feelings about the fact that the federal law passed with a 12-month threshold and felt like that wasn't quite appropriate, that 18 months would better serve the purpose of fulfilling the needs. It's also important to underscore this temporary accommodation that employers are making for milk expression during the workday. It decreases over time. So between the 12 months and the 18 months, it's not necessarily it would be rare that the full number of breaks would be needed, similar to milk expression for a really young child. Mm-hmm. But we think that the 18 months is the more appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Tomei.
Yes, ma'am.
I ask a couple of our colleagues who are on that original bill if they wanted to testify. Both Representative Gelser and Olson said they would like to, but like the rest of us, they're in committee right now. Representative Olson, who was one of your vice chairs, sent his testimony, and I want to do two things. I just want to highlight the comments that he had, and also, I don't know how we do this, request that his statement or written testimony be put in the record. Is that,
sure,
is that
absolutely
possible?
And we have all of these.
The other?
All of these have been written about this legislation.
So we have lots of
writing. Lots of things that will be in the record, right?
All right.
Isn't that right, Jennifer?
I particularly, so that I'll ask that be submitted, but I particularly want to highlight a couple of things of concerns that Representative Olson had because of his involvement with our committee before. And he said he's going to be in committee and all of that. I don't need to read the whole thing. But he has been discussing it with folks in his district, and particularly he's mentioning chambers of commerce. And there were three concerns, some of which we've already raised, but I'll just bring them up. Section 1, he said, this is Representative Olson, creates a burden on the employer and workplace. Clearly, an employee expecting to give birth to a child should be in a position to give ample notice to the employer their intention concerning the issue. This gives the employer an opportunity to prepare accommodations for the employee. Second concern was from page 1, lines 15 through 18. He thinks that they should stay intact. This has been well accepted in the business community and is working quite well. And lastly, Representative Olson says Section 1
sub 4, puts the burden of proof on the employer, even though the employee threshold level has been increased to 50. The majority of small businesses request and supports the original language identified in page 2. I think that would be the original bill, lines 21 through 24. Other than those concerns, he ends with the fact that most of the folks he talked to support the concept. I thought that was worth highlighting. You don't have to comment on that, and we'll ask that to be included in the record, but you're welcome to if you'd like. Are there any other questions at this point yet, Representative?
Picky question. As a small employer, if I want to appeal this to the committee, who is on the committee? And specifically, are there neutral parties? I think it's odd that only one person has chosen to go that route.
Chair Gilliam, Vice Chair Thompson, members of the committee, the advisory committee is statutory, and it's required that it is comprised of equal representation of members from labor and members from management. Currently sitting in our...
That's funny. That answers my question.
Do you want to hear who's on it?
If you want to, but...
Why don't we move on?
Okay. Yeah, okay.
That's fine. You're good on that question. Yeah. Thank you. We have one other person... who's signed up to testify, and I don't see him in the room. Would it be possible to see if J.L. Wilson is nearby? Don't spend too much time on it. But if he is, he's welcome to come in.
He was here, so I walk out.
And I assume there are no others in the room who wish to testify today on 2038. We'll just give it a second.
Coalition.
That
might be a little deterrent.
Yeah,
right.
Oh. Sorry. It's okay. Still stands. We can put his in there. There are no others that would wish to testify today, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2038. And I would like to open a work session, the last of the three that you see in your agenda, on House Bill 2235. And I'm hoping that Representative Widener will tell us a little bit about this bill. From memory, don't give him that.
Did you say you opened a work session?
No, if I did, I apologize. Make sure the record is correct. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2235. Thank you, Representative. Representative Widener.
We really don't want to hear this one, do we?
Representative Widener, now you have to do your part.
Okay. What the measure does requires Oregon Health Authority to provide training and informational materials concerning maternal mental health, healthcare providers serving pregnant, postpartum, and post-pregnancy loss patients, requires hospitals and healthcare providers serving reference patients to provide materials published or approved by Oregon Health Authority, allows Oregon Health Authority to apply for federal grants to provide training and materials, declares an emergency effective on a passage. We do have an amendment brought forth, effective a committee amendment. The department will provide training and informational materials outlined in the measure only if sufficient funding is received through various private and federal funding sources, to include grants, donations, and gifts. Would you like the background, Representative?
No, that's just what I needed. That's what I needed. You're just fine. So we
have a lot more information here.
No, that's good. I'll get back to you. We have a number of individuals who'd like to testify, and we've got 25 minutes before our session begins upstairs. So I'd like to invite Wendy Davis, Brian Boehringer, and Ann Stone to come up.
This is.
Oh, Ann's not here.
This isn't what he said.
How about, yes, Mr.
Just a point of clarification. The amendment I have to Section 4 isn't exactly what Representative Widener presented. This says provisions, CARE Act provisions, upon receipt of sufficient funding. I don't see grant funding. And
you're looking at a dash 4, Representative?
I'm looking at dash 1.
Dash 1.
Okay. I think Representative Widener said private funding and grant funding or something like that. And this, the dash 1 I have, says just sufficient funding, which would imply... Oh, okay.
Sufficient funding. So these sections, sections 1 and 2 and 3 in the original bill reference sufficient funding.
Okay. So I just want to clarify reference. If the funding is coming from grants and private sources, or the funding is coming from the general fund, or if all options are open.
It references, Mr. Chair,
please.
It references sufficient funding through those various aspects, which may be federal-funded donations or grant funding.
Okay.
So the need to clarify on dash 1 is duly noted, and we will get to that after the general testimony on the bill.
Thank you.
But I appreciate you bringing that up.
I always want to know where the funding is coming from.
And I want to also invite Jillian Rom. Is that right? Is Jillian here? So we can do three at a time. So if you would...
Be brief.
You probably heard this before, but be brief. You don't need to read your testimony if we've got it. But we are glad you're here. Please proceed.
Thank you very much, Representative Gilliam and Rep. Tomei and the rest of the committee. First of all, I want to say happy Valentine's Day and happy birthday, Oregon. I don't know if we all remember
said.
That. And we are so pleased to be here with all of our hearts in front of the House Human Services Committee again. And I do want to first, I'm Wendy Davis. I am the, I was the chair of the Oregon Maternal Mental Health Work Group that was created by legislation carried by this committee in 2009. And I'm a psychotherapist in private practice in Portland. I'm also the program director for an organization called Postpartum Support International. I want to talk just about the context in two ways of this bill. The first is it's been a complete privilege and delight to be part of a legislative process in Oregon. I was trained as a therapist. I got into nonprofit work. I'm a survivor of postpartum depression and anxiety. I never imagined, dang it, 16 and a half years ago that I would be here. And I want to thank Representative Tomei for having the courage and wisdom to bring maternal mental health into Oregon as a legislative priority. And what's happened since 2008 when you first brought this up is that we have an amazing collaborative, interdisciplinary, diverse effort of study and research and recommendation. This bill comes out of all of that. The other... sense of context that I want to talk about is that we all know, and the work group really, really looked hard at this, that public awareness and provider education has to go hand in hand for good health care. Because as we found and as I always say the patient is part of the treatment team, and the best way to reduce cost and increase preventive efforts is to include patient education, empowerment, and their ability to not be ashamed to reach out for help and the efficiency with which they can do so. That's what this bill is about. So what I want you to be mindful of is that... is how we have already been talking to primary care providers, and that I know that we really have a bill that can make things happen when I have to I got to spend 10 minutes in the hallway talking to the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Pediatric Society, and really making sure we were on the same page, and that they this bill got their attention. They said, wait a minute, can we do this? I know we're on the right track. So we've gone a step-by-step process. The first bill that we created was to have maybe Maternal Mental Health Awareness Month every year in Oregon in front of this committee and passed unanimously. Very simple public awareness and provider awareness as well. The second bill was to create the workforce, the work group. The work group, after all of its recommendations that you see in our beautiful report, we brought this to this committee last September. And out of all the recommendations we made, there was only one legislative recommendation, and this bill is it. It's we worked very hard, decided not to have a mandate for screening, for treatment, for referral. This is really about education for families and support for providers so that they know what to look for and where to find help. So the visualization I want you to imagine is a very simple, direct brochure that's created by the Oregon Health Authority with input from all of these sources that can be given to all patients, not because we think they look like they need it, because we can't tell. It's because this is standard of care. One out of every 8 women in pregnancy or postpartum has a serious and significant psychological disorder. One out of every 8. And yet, because of the taboo, the shame, the fact that we are afraid to think about a mother with poor mental health, we're afraid of it. And so instead of working harder to prevent this, we've looked away. We don't want to talk about it. And what we're doing is trying to get everyone on board, as we like to say as providers. We talk to all our families about this, not because you look like you need it, but because it's the best care we can give. And what Oregon can do is be a pioneer. There are 5 other states that provide education to all of their patients on prenatal and postpartum mood disorders, what to look for and where to find help. And Oregon can be the 6th and continue in our in our reputation and leadership in really taking care of the maternal mental health needs of families. So we, as from the work group, we know this is the next step. We know it's not too large a step. And we know that we can prevent trauma and the costs associated with not educating families and providers to know where to find help. So thank you so much for letting me testify today, and I'm here for any questions or answers. Thank you.
Do you have a thank you for your testimony, and do you have a quick comment on about Representative Thompson's question on the Dash Ones? Where does the money emanate from?
I think that it's possible that Catherine Bradley can answer that in the next panel of testifiers, but what I would say quickly is that, again, from our recommendations on the work group, we're very, very aware, and we spent a lot of time talking about the economic climate, and we only want to present something that's reasonable, feasible, and sustainable. So, in short, the money, there are federal grants available. There is a lot of private and nonprofit support in Oregon, but we didn't want to specify it. For one thing, the names even of the organizations are always changing. So we wanted to keep it open enough and designate that we will be looking for, all of us together looking for funds. But we also didn't want to just say, well, we can do this. We don't need the state's support. We don't need legislation, because we've been doing that for 16 years in Oregon, and it was only when we got legislation that it's really moving statewide, getting into diverse communities, going to the rural areas, because we have a statewide legislation to support these efforts.
Okay, thank you. Representative White.
Thank you, Chair Gilliam. Real quick on this, because this is a very important issue, and it seems like it's being brought to the forefront even more so, because I have 4 boys. My youngest is 14, and I can remember with the youngest actually getting information in the hospital. And I'm wondering if this is going to cover what we need to, because it almost seems like it needs to be covered in follow-up visits when after you've had the child, and a few weeks, a month down the road, the doctor shouldn't be seeing him, or if there shouldn't be something that's happening there. on that side that should be addressed by the medical community in general. And it's a shame we've kind of ran a lot of our OBGYNs out of business, or, well, they don't like to practice or deliver babies anymore because of liability issues, but is this going to do what we need to do, or should we be looking at doing something like that, I guess would be my question.
Oh, Representative Widener and co-chairs, I really appreciate that question. And the answer is, with regard to this bill, we don't want to mandate any treatment, screening, or identification, because we want it to. We want this to be the first, the next step. It isn't enough to treat adequately. You're right. But that's why we have all the rest of our recommendations that we're all working on in our professional societies. And so you're correct that it's not enough to fully treat, but it's enough for this bill. What we want then is, as one piece of the bill, if you read it, is to support the training of providers so that they get ongoing around the state in different locations and through webinars. This is already starting to happen, but they get the information that you need to follow up. You need to have the pamphlets just out in your waiting room. You really do. Because you never know, even if a provider forgets to mention it, that you have materials available so the family, the dad, the partner, the grandmother says, oh, what's this? Oh, this is us. So, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Couple questions. In reading this first part of this, it says this is created in the Oregon Health Authority. So is there then an oversight person jobs that need to be created within the Oregon Health Authority? Because the gentleman who presented earlier was a different part of kind of that budget, talking about earned positions and not having enough dollars to staff them. I'm curious about that piece of it. Can you speak to that? And I do have a follow-up.
I'm going to leave that for the next panel.
Okay. And then the second piece, I've had three babies in the last decade. You know, the hospital is wonderful about giving us this information, and I think there's definitely a difference between a parent with a one-time isolated, I can't handle my children today, and then that long-term, you know, what we see with babies and families, you know, where mom is suffering, and then we read about it in a newspaper that she's harmed her children in some obscene way. And so I think there's a lot of attention on this right now. I guess my experience with having kids is you know, the folks who delivered did that follow-up real well. And then our pediatrician was, you know, significantly involved in, you know, as we were coming in for shots and doing all of that process. And, you know, how are you handling this? So I guess I'm curious, because I've had those experiences in two different OBGYNs and sort of pediatricians, that is this not happening? I mean, do you really feel like that providers aren't giving the level of support that women need? I mean, I know a lot of women who've suffered this and felt like their providers were right on board. So I just want to kind of get a sense of where you feel
that
discrepancy is happening.
Thank you so much, Representative Parrish. And co-chairs, you've had a wonderful experience, and we want your providers to come help us train everyone else. You'll hear from other testimony that women are and families are not given this, sometimes because providers are afraid of scaring them or insulting them. That's a symptom of a taboo. We want everyone to know this can be a very normal, treatable, temporary part. And you've had a great experience. We want to extend that to rural areas, to providers who really don't know what to say. We want really to support them. Thank you.
I will just go on record. My first baby was in a rural area, and the senator on the other side of the building there was my provider. So
I'm actually not kidding about we want them to help us train.
Yeah.
So I'll talk to you later.
Senator Girard delivered your baby. Oh, he's a dentist.
I'm sorry.
Different doctor. Just a quick housekeeping here. I was talking to the co-chair, and we've only got 10 minutes before we got to go to the floor. Are there any individuals in the room that wanted to testify? I've got three or four more that cannot come back, because we're going to have a second hearing on this. And so you're here, so Jillian, please go ahead.
Is that okay?
Oh, yeah, I'm
stepping ahead.
He's going to hang out here anyway.
Co-chairs Gilliam and Tomei and members of this committee, thank you for letting me
speak now. I'm Jillian Rahm, and I'm the Director of Mental Health at the Center for Women's Health in the OBGYN department at OHSU. I've worked in women's health care for a really long time. I'll tell you about that in a moment. First as a nurse in labor and delivery and postpartum, and since 1990 as a clinical social worker in the OBGYN department at OHSU. I currently direct the mental health program, which is co-located within the clinic at the Center for Women's Health. I'm senior faculty at OHSU in the Department of OBGYN, where I oversee and provide direct counseling services for women and families in the center. I teach women's health care curriculum at OHSU to medical students, graduate nursing students, physician assistant students, and to the OBGYN residents. These are doctors who are doing their 4 years of specialty training in obstetrics. In my role in the department, I was appointed to this work group that made the recommendations that you're reviewing today. I was elected the chair of the services subcommittee, which is a clinical subcommittee, and I'm honored to provide testimony today. When I first came to the field of women's health, it was believed that pregnancy was actually protective in terms of women's psychological states, that bad things didn't happen to women during pregnancy. And if they did, when it happened rarely, the only provider to handle it should be a psychiatrist. That was the state of the art in 1976. Today, due to research and data, much of which you have in your report, we understand that mood and anxiety disorders are in fact common among reproductive age women, and many cases of illnesses go unnoticed, undiagnosed, and so untreated. Obstetricians are in the front line of providing prenatal care and postpartum care for women, and they're likely to be the first to notice that something is awry. The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, ACOG, is currently focusing on pregnant and postpartum women's mental health. Dr. Gerald Joseph, who's the current president of ACOG, has made postpartum depression the centerpiece of his initiative as president of the college. I have had long and productive conversations with Dr. Joseph about Oregon's initiative and the work group work. He has offered his full support and encouragement to Oregon's efforts, the result of which is the bill that you're considering. I've also spoken with Dr. Peter Palacio, who's an OBGYN from Bend, Oregon, and he's currently the president of the Oregon section of ACOG. We've talked about the work group recommendations and work, and I'm happy to report to you that our state ACOG chapter fully endorses and supports this work. I'm also speaking as a mother who had my own postpartum anxiety disorder that went untreated, unnoticed, and undiagnosed, although I had a lot of medical care and a lot of interactions with my providers during that time. I am so heartened to see a sea change in the field of obstetrical care from the beginning of my career until now, so that the understanding of perinatal mood and anxiety disorders is considered within the scope of obstetrical practice. This is what makes a difference on the ground to women, mothers, and young families. This bill will encourage training for women's healthcare clinicians, increase pregnant women's understanding about these disorders that are so common, and offer assessment and recommendations for new families. I heartily urge your support, and I'm happy to be a part of the obstetrical community that does as well. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? We're running out of time, but I did want to briefly tell you that years ago, I was on the staff of the Health Sciences Foundation, and I was given the task to help with the fundraising effort getting started for the center. Miles Novi and Mary Wilcox and some of those pioneers. So I was a very small part of that, but it was my pleasure to be part of that. So it's nice to see you today.
Thank you for how enlightened you were.
Thank you.
Don't let him fool you. We know the truth.
Going to get them all out of order. Again, is there anybody that signed up to testify that can't join us again when we schedule a hearing?
When will that be?
And I'm sorry to say we can't say, but if you... Why don't you come up? Brian has just given you his seat, and we'll have one more testimony, and then we will adjourn. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Identify yourself for the record and welcome.
Sure. My name is Sherry Lovery. I'm the owner and director of Crisis Management Institute. I'm not going to read my testimony as I wrote
Thank
it. I'm
you.
Going to start by telling you how I fit into these statistics, and then I'll do whatever I can with the minutes you give me. However, had I had the help that this could have provided, I was one of the 35% diagnosed with never diagnosed, but had depression after. The impact it has on family and relationships and the cost to you. So what I can say, did I finish Sherry Lovery, Crisis Management Institute? I'm for the record, thank you. So what I would say in terms of what this could save you financially in my own personal case, I probably only have the courage to say because I've become a successful person and have a national presence in responding to school shootings. I spent a week at Thurston High School in Springfield and a week at Columbine. I spent 2 years in New York after 9/11 working with the children that fled and the teachers that took them out of those buildings during the terrorist attacks. So I understand trauma from a very fundamental place. In using my professional understanding now to look back at what happened to me after the stillborn child I had, I realize your cost savings would have been 4 months of welfare that I went on in order to finish my college degree after a divorce that didn't need to happen, 2 years on food stamps in order to finish my college degree, a home loan for low-income single-parent mothers because I ended up in a divorce not having the help I needed, and daycare partial payment for my son for 4 years. So when I look at the financial cost to you, they're terrific. What happened for me wasn't full-term pregnancy. I had an unremarkable pregnancy, first with one son who was born. I then had 3 miscarriages. My 5th pregnancy went into the 7th month, and I was elated, thinking, finally, I'd broken the spell. I went into the emergency room, and my own physician was out of town, so I was dealt with by a physician who was unknown to me, who went on at length about his vacation in Aspen to the nurses and then only addressed me when he told me that he wanted to take a cutting of the placenta. I'd assumed the IVs they were starting would be to stop my labor and go home. And when he asked for that, I asked if it wouldn't risk infection to the baby, to which he simply said, "Baby, lady, your baby is dead." And he left the room. The nurses in the emergency room, the nurses up on the floor where they took me to have this child, were wonderful, but silent. They had no words to give me any sense of what was to ensue for me. So I spent 24 hours in the hospital, and in answer to your question of can it come weeks later, I needed that help at that time so I could know what was going to ensue for me. I went home to the silence of flowers, and my living room reminded me only of a funeral home, but no one would say anything about anyone had died. In my months after that, not one person in my family, not one person in my world related to the fact that I'd been pregnant and that my flat belly and my empty arms were met by silent stares of compassion, but no words to help me understand why I had been plunged into depression. So my husband continued to cheer me on, saying, "Look how easily we conceive. Surely one of these will work." And what I found when I got home is that it was just easier when I put my son down for his nap to have a little wine. We had decided to manage an apartment house because I thought I'd be at home with 2 little ones, and so now I was stuck at home with only my sweet 3-year-old to talk to. So I'd put him to bed for his nap, and I'd drink a little wine, and within weeks I was finishing a bottle off every day or two. I had another miscarriage the following July, and at that point realized I had to change my life. I signed up to go back to school and finish my degree. I don't think that going back to college helped save my marriage, but it did save my life because it gave me something to which I had to attend every day. It made me have to have a quick mind every evening while I was studying, and so I don't think I ever made a decision to stop drinking, but I think it simply fell away, and I think I'm one of the very few really lucky ones. I was able to pull myself up by my bootstraps alone and finish college with the help of 4 months of welfare and 2 years of food stamps, but that I think I'm one of the few women who was able to make that transition. I can tell you that 30 minutes by someone who could have sat down with me at the hospital before I ever left to say, this is what is going to ensue. People don't know how to help you. They don't know how to talk about it. They don't understand what your loss is about. They'll turn away in silence because that's the best they can do. And that what I needed was for someone to give us the insight to know that my husband and I, with just a little counseling, could have had that challenge pull us together instead of drive us apart. So yes, it can be very brief. It can cost nothing. A nurse in that floor who had had the insight in what needed to be said could have made the difference for me in being a single parent mother, living in my early years very much on the edge of financial survival. So I think when I look through here, I earmarked several pages that relate to me and relate to what simply 30 minutes of someone who had the insight and the courage. And I think that what's wonderful about this is that I know from my work in trauma when I go in after school shootings, what we need to do is give people language. Administrators don't know where to start. They don't know how to talk to the press. They don't know how to portray what's happened. They don't know how to build trust between the families and the students after a horrendous incident. My job is really going in to give language, to just bring the beam of hope that says, while you have no hope right now, I'm here to hold that for you until you find it yourselves and begin to create your new normal. That's what I needed someone to say, that I wasn't crazy. The balm of those words, you're not crazy. The dissonance of their silence and my screaming pain, someone to say you're not crazy. This doesn't have to pay for that therapy. If I'd known I'd needed it, I would have taken it. I thank you so much for giving me this 3 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you very much for taking the time and the courage to come and tell your story. It's very, very compelling. Thank you. Committee members, I'm going to have to close the public hearing on House Bill 2235.
So we're going to carry this one, right?
Thank you.
We got to talk about how we carry it over. So I'm going to close the Committee on Human Services for today. Thank you.